From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Bells and Whistles is the media slot machine when triple sevens filling forth the glittering coin of sex, murder, and sleaze. The latter contributed by certain news outlets that will not go nameless. Meanwhile, accused child killer Casey Anthony is acquitted, sparking outrage in the public and punditocracy. Meanwhile, the hotel maid who accused French politico Dominique Strauss-Kahn of rape is accused in turn of being a prostitute by Rupert Murdoch's New York tabloid, The Post. She's suing. Meanwhile, the most sordid and transgressive of Murdoch's British tabloids, News of the World, transgresses so sordidly that the whole of the United Kingdom is in an uproar. Bob, start there.
All right, will do. A sleazy scandal of the sort long exploited by News of the World has led Murdoch's News International to close down News of the World.
What has truly outraged Britain is the allegation that just came out that the News of the World may have hacked into the voicemail of a 13-year-old girl who was abducted and murdered.
It was Britain's worst peacetime act of terrorism, but now there are concerns that families of those killed on 7/7 in 2005 were also eavesdropped upon by journalists.
It had gone from celebrity phone hacking to murdered victim hacking to bomb victim hacking to soldiers and dead soldiers hacking.
And an arrest in that huge hacking scandal in Britain, the News of the World's former editor and the Prime Minister's former aide.
The murdered girl's name was Millie Dowler. The gruesome details about how the News of the World listened to and then deleted messages on her voicemail, giving the family false hopes and hampering the police investigation, proved to be the boiling point for this long-simmering scandal.
The incident triggered advertiser defections and stirrings in a government and public long quiescent about sleazy tabloid tactics and Murdoch's looming presence in British politics and industry. News International's case certainly wasn't helped by rationalizations offered by staffers, such as this one by former News of the World eavesdropper Paul McMullen.
I don't really like the word hacking. I mean, basically just having a little bit of a listen to someone's messages. And given it's someone's messages on their own personal phone, chances are that it's going to be the truth. And journalists, by and large, are just trying to write the truth.
Until the Millie Dowler details surfaced, years of sporadic reporting about similar voicemail hacking had barely ruffled the nation, despite the efforts of one paper, the broadsheet Guardian, to hold Murdoch and British officialdom accountable. Roy Greenslade, the Guardian's media critic, says his paper was a lonely muckraker.
For at least 4 years, the Guardian has ploughed a lonely furrow trying to get people interested in the whole subject of phone hacking. And quite suddenly, the public were calling into radio phone-in shows. They were ringing up the newspaper and abusing the journalists. And it began to reach the point where advertisers were saying, OK, we're going to pull our ads. And then in a series of days, almost hourly, we discovered that other murder victims' parents had been hacked into. We discovered that the victims of the 7/7 bombing had been listened into. We discovered that soldiers and personnel who'd been killed on active service, that their relatives were having their phones hacked into. This had become a giant shockwave, and it's in response to that that Rupert Murdoch and his company have taken this dramatic action by closing the newspaper.
Now, James Murdoch, making this announcement, spun it as taking the high road, as having been so appalled by the conduct of his employees that he had no choice but to shut down the discredited newspaper. What he didn't discuss was what Murdoch's company was trying to preserve by taking this extraordinary action. There is a lot at stake for News Corp, no?
Well, it was strange that this should have broken on the very week when Rupert Murdoch was expecting the British government to give him leave to obtain the 61% of the satellite TV broadcast company, B Sky B, that he has been desperate to get hold of. So the general view is that this is a wholly ruthless and cynical act to close the newspaper, to shut down the argument, as it were, to seal the company off in order to ensure that his bid for the broadcaster goes ahead.
You know, American tabloids tend to be more populistic and sensational than broadsheets. But when we're discussing British tabs, it's hard to find a comparison of any kind on this side of the ocean. Even the National Enquirer next to the News of the World just oozes with gravitas.
Certainly, since the News of the World adopted a tabloid shape, which was in 1984, it has grown year by year more and more sleazy and sordid, with pictures of semi-naked women, sometimes naked women, stories of a very, very questionable nature, celebrities talking about the most intimate details of their sex lives. It has been one squalid mess for a long time, and it has done that against the background of ever-falling sales. Back in 1950, the paper was selling 8.4 million copies an issue, making it probably the best-selling newspaper in the world. By last month, that was down to 2.6 million, which is still a lot of papers, it has to be said, still made it the Sunday market leader. I think one of the interesting things is that in many ways, the News of the World style of journalism was already on the back foot. The encroachment of laws to protect privacy and the tightening of laws to prevent many of the activities, the methods that the News of the World had got up to, were already impinging on its style of journalism.
Rupert Murdoch is a tycoon here, but in the UK, he is a press baron in a sense that we have long since ceased to see in our country.
You'd have to go back to William Randolph Hearst, really, to get a sense of what Rupert Murdoch means in the British political world. He is thought to be somebody who can deliver votes and therefore skew how elections turn out. Prime ministers have made it a habit to cozy up to Rupert Murdoch. Those political leaders that have got on the wrong side of him have found that they have suffered his wrath, and it is generally accepted that at least one major general election was lost by the Labour leader because of the way he was treated by Murdoch's papers. He uses his political skills in order to obtain business advantages, and then he uses his business, and his business is the media, in order to gain political leverage.
A virtuous circle, minus perhaps only virtue. Yet all at once, after more than three decades of this kind of relationship with the institutions of power, it seems like those institutions have coalesced almost as one to turn on Murdoch. You know, it reminds me of nothing so much as the Arab Spring. Is he Hosni Mubarak?
The really odd thing about this is that Rupert Murdoch has not, until virtually this week, throughout his whole career in Britain, he has not been a demon king. The media elite, the political elite, have paid court to him and taken him very seriously, but the public as a whole have not known much about him. But this week, the worm has turned. And, of course, you know, politicians are very quick to feel the pulse of the public during what amounts to really is a feeding frenzy. And so suddenly, Murdoch's old friends, or at least people that have not bothered to speak up about him in the past, have turned on him in a way that he can least have expected. He has suddenly gone from being Uncle Rupert to being Demon Rupert.
But what about the rest? They have a lot to answer for. Are parliamentarians, is Prime Minister Cameron, is Scotland Yard suddenly at pains to explain why they have been so in Murdoch's thrall?
Oh, I think we've got lots of questions to answer. He's tried to draw a line under this affair by closing the newspaper, but all it's going to do is raise yet more questions. Questions about the relationships between Murdoch's senior executives and Murdoch himself and the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister and the people around the Prime Minister. It's going to raise important questions about the relationship between his journalists and the Metropolitan Police, who have failed to carry out proper investigations in the past. And so I think that we are really on the verge of seeing a great turnaround in the way that Murdoch is treated by the authorities, by the institutions, because the public are not going to forget what has happened. This has really impinged on the public consciousness like no other media event I can remember. I just want to get across, really, in a sense, how unprecedented this is. A newspaper has been closed while still making a profit, while still being the market leader, and while still employing a full staff. I mean, it is a really incredible turn of events, and I've been stretching my mind back into history and cannot see that it has ever happened before.
Well, the empire has long since disintegrated. The Beatles broke up. Now the news of the world is closing. Whatever could be next? The monarchy?
I'd like to think so, because I happen to be a Republican, but I think the monarchy has been saved by the glamorous newly married prince and his wife, who seem to have given it a new lease of life.
Well, thank God for that. Roy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Roy Greenslade comments on the media for The Guardian and is a professor of journalism at City University, London.
Coming up, more media malfeasance, misfeasance, and everything in between.
This is On the Media.
If you want to know about the bishop and an actress, if you want to know how to be a star, if you want to know about the stains on the mattress, you can read it in the Sunday papers.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's up for debate whether the news of the world marks a new low for journalism. But consider another famous case of voicemail hacking. 14 years ago, the Cincinnati Inquirer undertook a massive probe into the practices of Cincinnati-based global behemoth Chiquita. After a year of work by two reporters at a cost of some $100,000, the Inquirer published a scathing expose documenting Chiquita's business malpractices, involving lawbreaking in four countries, bribery, exposing workers to harmful pesticides, and bulldozing villages to make room for bananas. Then, some 2 months later, the Inquirer renounced the series. Apparently, reporter Mike Gallagher had obtained some material by breaking into Chiquita's voicemail system. The Inquirer fired Gallagher, relocated his editor, who knew about some of the hacking, agreed to pay Chiquita millions of dollars, apologized three times, and recanted the stories. In Britain, the phone hacking scandal dragged on for years. Here, the reaction was fast and furious. But the reaction to Chiquita's wide-ranging illegalities? Mostly there wasn't any. Ethicist Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute has used the Cincinnati Inquirer saga in classes as an object lesson.
The lesson is, when your methods for gathering information are dishonest, the information you gather is suspect. And that case is the perfect lesson in that no one has challenged the findings of the newspaper, yet nobody talks about that as a great investigative piece. They talk about it as an ethical scandal.
But isn't that because the Inquirer renounced its year-long investigation?
I think they had to do it to avoid further financial damage. They were being sued, and its losses were in the millions. So that's the point at which great journalism gets lost.
Well, I can certainly see that it posed a serious financial threat to the newspaper. But it seemed that the Cincinnati Inquirer had a higher obligation to stand by the story that exposed the unsavory business practices of a leading corporate citizen, which had ties to the government there and also ties to the newspaper.
As a watchdog holding a corporate citizen accountable, that's a major, major role of an American newspaper. The problem is if someone has a legal knife to your throat, you forego your paper's ability to ever do that again if you can't get out from that civil liability. And it's not, I mean, estimates are that they had to pay somewhere between $10 and $50 million to Chiquita. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not defending the retraction as much as I am
condemning the practice of voicemail hacking.
Exactly. There are so many times when you're tempted to do something that's slightly illegal. Somebody leaves the office when you're interviewing them and their computer screen's open, or somebody gives you a password or tells you how to get to information. And it seems so innocuous when you're gathering thousands and thousands of small pieces of information. But in fact, it can undermine every ounce of credibility that you have.
But when you consider the stakes, Chiquita, at the time that this story was being produced, was paying protection money to death squads in Colombia. These death squads were later designated terrorist groups by the U.S., and Chiquita was ultimately forced to pay $25 million in government fines. Here's what strikes me as really ironic. They had three choices. They could not pay the protection money and see their employees murdered. They could pay the protection money and stay in Colombia. Or they could pack up and move out of Colombia and lose an incredibly rich market. They chose to pay the protection money. It strikes me that this is a kind of an analogy for what the Cincinnati Inquirer did, pay the protection money, but at the cost of protecting a corporation that was doing genuine harm and causing lives to be lost abroad.
Perhaps, but if you look at all the other reporting that the Inquirer does in Cincinnati, covering the schools, covering government, enabling democracy to happen, one story versus thousands of stories. Because the Cincinnati Inquirer doesn't have the option of leaving Cincinnati.
What about the option of firing Gallagher, admitting his wrongdoing?
Well, one of the things about journalism is if you explain things ahead of time, you are in so much of a better position with the audience because you don't come off as defensive or guilty even. They didn't do that before they published. The Inquirer didn't know that thousands of times one of their reporters had listened to personal voicemails of an executive and were then up against a wall and didn't have a lot of options.
So maybe there's the object lesson. People will go astray. But if you're transparent at the beginning with that process, then the excellent and vital reporting will still stand.
Sure. The cliche is to ask forgiveness rather than permission. But in fact, in journalism, if you explain ahead of time to your audience what you did to get the information, the audience generally will back you up.
Kelly, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Kelly McBride is on the Senior Faculty for Journalistic Ethics at the Poynter Institute. This week, a Florida jury cleared Casey Anthony on charges that she murdered her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee, back in 2008. The public was stunned. The media were outraged.
We've been OJ'd. This is the worst thing to happen to Florida since the hanging chads. How did they miss the duct tape over this child's mouth, this child's nose? You don't wear duct tape to go swimming.
And when a 2-year-old goes missing and the mother doesn't even call 911, you're telling me the mother never neglected the child and she's missing and doesn't call 911? That's neglect, Geraldo.
Somewhere out there, the devil is dancing tonight.
In the court of public opinion, it seemed that Casey was found guilty long ago, but in a court of law, there just wasn't enough evidence to convict. Anthony's defense attorney, Cheney Mason, came out and blasted the media after the verdict for what he deemed 3 years of media assassination.
Well, I hope that this is a lesson to those of you who have been indulged in media assassination for 3 years, with bias and prejudice and incompetent talking heads saying what would be and how to be.
Why did the jury's verdict diverge so sharply from that of the public's and TV's talking heads? Kendall Coffey is a former U.S. attorney for Florida and author of Spinning the Law, Trying Cases in the Court of Public Opinion. And he's also logged a lot of time as a TV talking head. Welcome to the show, Kendall.
Thank you so much for having me. What a fascinating case.
What makes this so fascinating?
Well, it's the most horrifying kind of crime, a mother killing her child. It's got the elements of CSI that are just enthralling to the American public right
now. Like what?
For example, DNA, was there DNA, wasn't there? What about air sample testing? When had that been done before? And at the same time, Casey Anthony herself was utterly bewildering. She certainly didn't look like a killer, but she lied like a criminal. And 31 days of partying and lying and yet no real motive to kill her child were more than just intriguing. They were utterly puzzling, and I think part of what was difficult in reaching a verdict of guilty beyond reasonable doubt is the difficulty in figuring out Casey Anthony.
Now, HLN, the cable news channel that seems to have really made its bones on this story, has a correspondent named Jane Velez Mitchell who told the website Mediaite that TV viewers, quote, paid more attention than some of the jurors based on the legal system and reasonable doubt. Do you think the jury did its job?
Despite whatever we're hearing and seeing and even thinking outside the courtroom, they see the evidence, they see all the disputed points and contentions much better than any of us who are simply watching it from a distance.
Fair enough, but why are the public and the talking heads so sure that the jury got it wrong?
In the court of public opinion, there is no presumption of innocence. When we hear about charges being brought, what do we think? We think they probably did it. Where there's smoke, there must be fire. So we're in a completely different zone than the jurors who get in there. And maybe some of them had some predispositions because there was so much pretrial publicity. But nevertheless, they swear an oath, and conscientious jurors do everything they can to follow that oath. And that means really holding a prosecution to its burden of proof and examining each piece of evidence. The jury saw every minute of the trial. We didn't.
TV pundits tended to portray the prosecutors as doing very well and the defense is bumbling, right? This was the narrative they had decided upon and didn't diverge much from.
Commentators, including this one, have a tendency to pay too much attention to the lawyers. During sidebars or conferences that the jury never saw, the judge was frequently admonishing and was routinely critical of defense counsel. So they weren't winning with the judge, but that's a completely different question from how were they doing with the jury. We score style points because the prosecution seemed more prepared.
Are you suggesting perhaps that in order to get better commentary on these trials, it would be better to have non-experts in to evaluate how it's going?
Well, I think it would be really interesting to have human beings react.
As opposed to lawyers like yourself.
As opposed to lawyers. I have my human components. But I'm a lawyer, and that's my life, and that's how I react to things. And so it bothered me that the defense seemed to be disobeying court orders with respect to providing notification and evidence in advance to the prosecution. And maybe that affected some of my judgments. Didn't bother the jury. They didn't see any part of that.
Now, a lot of people have drawn comparisons between this trial and the O.J. Simpson case in terms of the coverage and also in terms of public engagement. But back then, we didn't have Facebook and Twitter enabling us to be constantly engaged with the trial. There's even an app on the iTunes store that allows users to watch a live stream of the trial, read court documents, stay updated with the case.
The O.J. case, I think, took trial watching to a new planet. But this case took it to a new galaxy for the reasons you've described. One other difference with O.J. is we are truly in a CSI age. And so much of this testimony was dueling forensic evidences. And when juries today are watching that, there's going to be terminology, there's going to be things before that they've seen on TV. And in this case, seeing no DNA anywhere that could link the defendant to the alleged crime, that starts out with nothing more as a positive for the defense.
So you're saying in a pre-CSI age, the jury might have found her guilty?
We'll never know.
Kendall, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke, for having me.
Kendall Coffey is a former U.S. attorney for Florida and author of Spinning the Law, Trying Cases in the Court of Public Opinion.
If you seek a respite from scandal this coming week, you might take in baseball's All-Star Game, where the boys of summer toil in the purity of the national pastime. Or not. The Los Angeles Dodgers are in bankruptcy. The New York Mets are trying to save the franchise after its principal owner lost a fortune in the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. Future Hall of Famer Roger Clemens is in federal court fighting perjury charges related to his alleged performance-enhancing drug use. And former All-Star Lenny Dykstra of the 1993 National League champion Philadelphia Phillies is in jail for an ever-growing list of theft, drug, and fraud charges. That development is pathetic but unsurprising to Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Frank Fitzpatrick, who saw it all coming. He covered the colorful but erratic player in his heyday and recently wrote a column regretting what may have been too much journalistic indulgence. Fitzpatrick says that Dykstra was an irresistible subject.
You know, when I think about Lenny, I think he embodies both versions of the word dirtball. In a good sense, he was a baseball dirtball, which meant he hustled and he dug and he tried to beat you in any way that he could. But in the negative sense of that word, he was rude and crude and astonishingly boorish. He would have been a great character for a novelist, let alone a baseball beat writer.
And Dykstra kind of chose you as much as you chose him as a subject. How so?
He was a great journalism junkie. He knew who every sports writer in every town was, who could write, who couldn't write, who might help him. And he identified me pretty quickly as a guy who could help him. And I, you know, being a new baseball beat writer, was sort of enamored that the star of the team had taken to me in a sort of warm, if Lenny could ever be considered warm, sort of way. And he knew what I wanted. I mean, he could be funny and, you know, he could be irascible and he could be the dude, which, you know, it was a character he sort of created for himself.
That's what he called everybody, right? He could never remember anybody's name, so he called everybody dude. And it came to be called the dude himself, right?
That's right. And the dude became sort of a caricature of who Lenny Dykstra was. I mean, this was a train wreck waiting to happen. And we knew this back then. And you know, you can't help but looking back thinking, you know, why didn't I do a little more in portraying this side of Dykstra instead of, you know, going out of my way to portray the other, the more appealing to me side of him?
What kind of stuff did you choose not to share with your readers?
Did we all suspect that he was doing steroids? Yes. Did we all suspect that he was taking greenies, you know, the amphetamines that were omnipresent in baseball clubhouses in those days? Yes. Did we know he cheated on his wife on the road? Yes. We knew all these things, and yet behind everything a baseball beat writer does, there's this fear of severing a good relationship, because without them in a competitive news environment, you're dead. So I think we're probably all guilty of hiding the true character of Lenny Dykstra for all those years.
The notion of a gentleman's agreement is not novel to journalism. White House reporters in the 60s, for example, were widely aware of President John F. Kennedy's sexual transgressions, but chose not to report them, I guess, on the grounds of what they deemed then to be irrelevance. But the gentleman's agreement about political peccadilloes has more or less dissolved over the decades. Does it still exist in professional sports writing?
These players and these teams are so much more savvy now about hiding people from the media, about training players how to deal with the media. I know when I interview athletes now, it's shocking to get anything out of the ordinary from them. They're so cautious and so careful. They have so much to lose. So whether that gentleman's agreement exists or not is difficult to say, because there isn't that same kind of closeness, that intimacy almost that we had with these guys. I mean, we were living with these guys for 6-7 months a year. And, you know, they didn't have as many places to hide as they do now.
The thrust of your column was that you harbor a sense of culpability, that you, in so cherishing this intimacy with Lenny Dykstra, became an enabler. If this were 1993, and you could do it all over again. The Phillies were on their way to the World Series, and Dykstra was a candidate for the Most Valuable Player Award, and you had written candidly about all of his excesses. What would have happened?
There would have been very few players that would have talked to me. You know, the manager would have been even more difficult to deal with. You would have been able to do your job, but only in the most routine, uninteresting fashion imaginable. In terms of inside information, you would have been lost.
Okay, so this is now 2011. This is an age when Brett Favre essentially puts his genitals up on eBay and it shows up everywhere. There seems to be no shyness about reporting the most crude, the most vulgar, the most licentious of behavior. Do you think that it's actually had an effect on the players? Does this change in journalistic culture actually force them to suppress their, let's say, basest tendencies?
No, I don't. But I do think they're more cautious about it. If you're using drugs, you've got drug tests. If you're going to a nightclub, you've got 100 people there with cell phones who know who you are. So this is a strange new world we live in, and I wouldn't want to be a player or a beat writer in it, to be honest with you.
All right, Fitz. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob. It was fun.
Frank Fitzpatrick is a columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Coming up, more media manipulations. Why stop now?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 1992, a young woman drove away from a McDonald's with a cup of coffee resting between her knees. She spilled the coffee in her lap, sued McDonald's for millions, and won. It's such a well-known part of pop culture, it made its way into a Seinfeld episode.
I spoke to a lawyer. We're suing for millions. Suing? What for? The coffee was too hot. It's supposed to be hot. Not that hot.
That someone could spill hot coffee on themselves, then cash in for millions is laughable. But the story, as most of us know it, simply isn't true. In a new HBO documentary titled Hot Coffee, former public interest lawyer-turned-filmmaker Susan Saladoff illustrates how the media distorted this case and many others and was used as part of a broader campaign to demonize litigation and prompt change in the civil justice system. Susan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Brooke. I appreciate you having me.
Let's start with the McDonald's coffee lawsuit. I mentioned what most people think they know about the case, but what actually happened?
Well, first of all, she wasn't a young woman. She was 79 years old. Mrs. Liebeck was a passenger in a parked car. McDonald's put the cream and sugar in the bag. This was an old-fashioned styrofoam cup, one of those small ones with the flat plastic lids mm-hmm. that had the little triangular opening that nobody could actually open. And she tried to open that, couldn't, so she took the top off. And the coffee was so hot that the cup literally collapsed. The coffee spilled into her lap, caused third-degree burns, which are the worst kind of burns that anyone could get.
We saw the pictures in the documentary, absolutely hellacious. We also learned that McDonald's kept its coffee at the time at a standing temperature of between 180 and 190 degrees, which a doctor said could account easily for the third-degree burns.
In fact, the quality assurance representative for McDonald's testified at trial that you can't drink coffee between 180 and 190 degrees, which in fact was their holding temperature by policy. And he said, if you try to drink coffee at that temperature, you will get burned. So they knew this, and they had over 700 claims that they had paid out and still did not reduce their coffee temperature.
And so the jury awarded her $2.9 million, which was later reduced by a judge to $640,000.
Right. And Mrs. Liebeck, by the way, wasn't looking for millions of dollars. All she wanted was the difference between what Medicare paid and what her medical bills were. And McDonald's never offered more than $800 at any time. And the jury did find her at fault. They found her 20% at fault because she, in fact, did spill the coffee on herself. But they found McDonald's 80% at fault because they had this long history of knowing that they were burning their customers and that they weren't doing anything about it. In fact, they were pretty callous about it.
In your film, you interview people on the street, and they don't know that side of the story.
Like, she was driving the car.
Tried to drive and drink it at the same time.
And then the lid might have popped open and it spilled on her lap.
Had it between her legs.
Spilled in her lap. It was too hot.
And then sued McDonald's
for millions of dollars.
Why did the reality of the incident and the public perception of the incident differ so much?
What's so crazy is that the night of the verdict, Jane Pauley was sitting in for Tom Brokaw in the NBC Nightly News, and she reported to the world the incorrect facts, that this woman was driving the car when the coffee spilled. The facts of this case were continually distorted by the media. You know, everyone likes the sensationalized headlines and the sexy, you know, big verdict for something crazy. People believe that because when you say these things enough times, people tend to think that they're true.
So there's a media narrative here, and maybe out of laziness or inattention, it never got corrected. But you also detail a very large PR campaign by big business to demonize this kind of litigation.
At the time that this verdict was rendered by the jury, there was a very big political push in this country by the Republican Party for so-called tort reform.
Let's talk about tort reform. This phrase was one of the clarion calls of groups that were funded solely by big business, but passed off as grassroots organizations, what's known as AstroTurf.
There was a huge public relations campaign started by large corporations, and they called them Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse, or CALAs. And they were set up all over the country as if citizens sprung up spontaneously outraged by all these lawsuits, when in fact, these Citizens Against Lawsuit groups, they were made up out of whole cloth from the public relations campaigns of groups like the American Tort Reform Association. Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds were big backers of these Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse groups because they made a product that killed people. And people were starting to use the civil courts to hold them accountable. We're talking about really 25 years ago or more is when it started.
And as a matter of fact, you note in the film a kind of proto-McDonald's story in a story about a telephone booth that President Ronald Reagan recounts.
In California, a man was using a public telephone booth to place a call. An alleged drunk driver careened down the street, lost control of her car, and crashed into the phone booth. Now, it's no surprise that the injured man sued, but you might be startled to hear whom he sued. The telephone company and associated firms. That's right.
The telephone booth was in a very dangerous place, and it had been hit several times, and the telephone company had never properly fixed the door. So even though he was trying to get out, he couldn't get out, and so he was hit in the booth. He lost his leg, and so it wasn't a real joke the way President Reagan had portrayed it.
There's a whole other media angle to this, which involves Citizen United, that groundbreaking decision by the Supreme Court to accord corporations the rights of individuals to free speech and to enable them basically to funnel unlimited amounts of money into political advertising.
So in most of our states now, we elect our judges, and that means they have to raise money. And what's happened over the last many years is that large corporate interests have decided, well, we want to get rid of these judges who are on our state Supreme Courts who are more pro-consumer. And so they started hand-picking candidates and funneling money into their campaigns, again, through front groups like Citizens for a Stronger Ohio or Citizens for a Safer Community. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which most people don't know, is the largest lobbying group for corporations in the world. They've been shown to be funneling money into these political campaigns.
And this was long before Citizens United. In fact, you have John Grisham talking about his book, The Appeal.
The Appeal was a book I published. It's a novel. It's completely fiction. And it's completely true. It's a story of the purchasing of a Supreme Court seat in Mississippi.
So tell me about the fate of Mississippi Judge Oliver Diaz.
Justice Diaz was on the Mississippi State Supreme Court, and he was targeted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because he wasn't pro-business enough.
Diaz even voted to overturn a cocaine conviction because evidence of a prior cocaine sale was allowed. Oliver Diaz, very bad judgment.
The statistics are that the candidate who has the most money for political ads will win about 90% of the time. He actually wound up winning the race despite all of the money that was put into his opponent's race. And when he won, he was then brought up on false criminal charges and was acquitted, but was off the bench for 3 years while he was fighting those charges. And then, of course, his reputation was tarnished and he was unable to win in the next election.
I think one of the most alarming images from your gripping documentary is simply the picture of a headline from a paper in Mississippi, which read, "Mississippi victims losing 100% of appeals, court ignoring juries."
For 2 years, a plaintiff, a person who was injured, even if they won a case, could not have their verdict upheld by the state Supreme Courts. And this was happening all over the country, not just in Mississippi.
You have a big dog in this fight, don't you, Susan, having practiced as a personal injury lawyer for years? Isn't your film just shriekingly one-sided?
I definitely have a point of view. I lived this. This is my truth. I practiced law for 25 years, and I saw for all of those years how difficult it was for people to get justice because the system is totally rigged against the average person. And most people didn't get it until they needed it, until it affected them personally. And then when they needed the system and they realized, oh my, the system isn't there for me, I just got angry and I wanted the truth to come out. Everybody's heard the other side of the story, but nobody's heard this side.
But there are frivolous lawsuits that waste taxpayer time and money. Wouldn't you concede?
Are there outliers? Are there some cases that get to court that shouldn't? Of course, we can't prevent that. We have a system where if a person is injured, they get the right to bring a case. But are there checks and balances in the system already? Absolutely. If you file a case and the judge believes that it's truly frivolous, number one, the judge will throw it out and the person can get fined. And then there are also checks and balances, as in the McDonald's case, where the judge can reduce the verdict. The reason we're talking about all these frivolous lawsuits is, again, because of this huge public relations campaign that was repeated over and over again. Greedy trial lawyer, frivolous lawsuit, jackpot justice. When you repeat things so many times, we start to believe these things.
Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Saladoff's HBO documentary is titled Hot Coffee. Her website is hotcoffeethemovie.com.
I sued Starbucks because I spilled a Frappuccino in my lap and burr, it was cold.
Susan Saladoff concluded by showing how skillfully PR practitioners can coin phrases to make a point. Our language is extremely malleable. Longtime OTM producer Mike Volo is a language maven and hobbyist of the first order and is developing a podcast called Lexicon Valley to explore some of the lesser-known byways of evolving English. We're done with media mischief this hot summer day. So here's a taste of Mike and Bob and Lexicon Valley.
Bob, it's arguably the most significant grammatical change to occur in the English language since Shakespeare. What is it?
I don't know. Semicolostomy.
I'm not really sure what that is.
That's more of a punctuation issue more than grammar. So
it sounds more like a medical issue to me.
But that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, the actual answer is the progressive passive.
Right.
Well, never mind the progressive passive for a moment. Let's just remind ourselves what the progressive tense is. It's some form of the verb to be plus another verb in its ing ending. For example, she is singing the blues. They were playing tennis.
I am listening to you with diminishing interest. Oh.
Ouch.
Oh. I didn't mean that.
I'm sure you didn't.
So the progressive tense suggests ongoingness.
That's right. Whatever you're doing is in progress, so to speak. Now, up until around the mid-1800s or so, there was another construction that was similar to the progressive, but it was in a kind of passive voice. So you might say, the house is building, meaning the house is in some unfinished state of buildedness. The refreshments were preparing. This was called the passival.
It imputes onto inanimate objects a kind of action.
Exactly.
it's weird.
Yeah, weird. Though you've probably come across the passival without even realizing it. In fact, Jane Austen used it quite a bit in her very first novel, Northanger Abbey. She writes, "The clock struck 10 while the trunks were carrying down." In Little Dorrit, Charles Dickens writes, "The street lamps were lighting." To our ears, it sounds really strange. 200 years ago, 400 years ago, it was common. And the question is, what happened to it?
Excuse me, Mike, I'll ask the questions here.
Okay.
What happened to it?
Well, I asked David Dennison. He's an editor of A History of the English Language. And he told me that sometime in the late 1700s and early 1800s, certain people in England started saying instead of the house was building, something else.
The house was being built. And at first, this was only for conversation, private letters, diaries. But then it started creeping into cheap novels and newspapers. And as soon as it reached the wider public, people went ape. You have printed this appalling expression. It's uncouth English, an outrage upon English idiom to be detested, abhorred, execrated. A lot of people were very upset about it.
The scolds never win, do they?
For the most part, they don't win because the language has a mind of its own. And what's interesting is that for decades, the two ways of saying the same thing kind of coexisted, the passival and the progressive passive. Dickens ended up using both. There's a great example of an English writer of the 1800s named Walter Savage Landor, who used both in a single sentence, probably without even thinking about it. He writes, "While the goats are being milked and such other refreshments are preparing for us as the place affords."
Now, what's amazing to me here is not that the progressive passive would become the default way of expressing the idea of ongoingness a century and a half later, but that the passival just kind of disappeared from the face of the earth.
It got completely muscled out of the language. And history has a way of making you seem kind of fussy and pedantic when you resist changes in the language. A century earlier, the passival was being attacked by none other than the famous lexicographer Samuel Johnson, who called it vicious. He thought it was a kind of corruption. And here's what Dennison had to say.
So suddenly the older construction, which had been heavily criticized in the 18th century by Dr. Johnson, was now being defended as pure English by Dr. Johnson's equivalents 50, 80 years later, because there was a new usurper coming in and people do not like change.
That's interesting. So if Dr. Johnson took umbrage with the passival, what was the standard usage before the passival?
I think for Dr. Johnson, the correct way to say the house is building would be to say the house is a building, the book is a printing, six geese a laying.
Five golden rings. And before that, assuming the language didn't begin at six geese a laying, where did that come from?
To say the book is a printing was a kind of corruption of the book is o printing, o apostrophe, itself a corruption of the book is on printing, the house is on building. So to resist any of these changes along the way would be to really fight the tide, which is why, Bob, you shouldn't want to, as you've said before, punch me repeatedly in the face for using impact as a verb.
And yet, Mike, and yet I do.
That's OTM producer Mike Volo with Bob. Oh, Mikey, Mikey, he's leaving us. We took him on his first foreign trip. We saw him get married and adopt a dog. We marveled as he reported first-rate stories on crossword contests and TV pitchmen. And we relied, oh, how we've relied, on his flawless radio pacing and discriminating ear for tape. Everything he's produced has a kind of music. Another thing, he's funny and sweet. We kind of love him. Oh, well.
For my part, for all of the reasons Brooke elucidated and more, I cannot tell you how much I will miss Mike Volo. As it turns out, he is moving right near my house in suburban Washington, though I'm not going to tell him exactly where I live. That's it for this week's show.
On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And if you need a personal Mike Volo fix, his new acrostic is posted on our website.
No one has been able to solve it yet.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.